A Biblical Politics, Two Possible Answers, Part 1, was presented by Jack Crabtree and Tim McIntosh on August 14, 2009, at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Paychecks, Politics, and Paradigms. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2009. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. This recording was made in a classroom setting, and some of the questions were inaudible. It is hoped that the presenter's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
Tim and I are going to have a conversation. I'm going to present a perspective. Tim will present another perspective. Tim will probably ask me to respond to something about mine, and I will ask him to respond to something about his. We'll go back and forth until we're bloodied, and then we'll open it up for questions and answers and discussion. The focus right now, as I see it, is I find the whole realm of politics, economics, and everything very, very confusing. And I suspect many of you do as well, and that your desire is, how should I, as a follower of Jesus, how should I think about my role as a citizen, as an American? Do I get involved in politics? Do I stay out of politics? Do I vote Democrat, Republican, conservative, liberal? Those are the issues that worry us, I think. And partly focus here is, what should we do as Christians living in America today? That's more or less the broad topic that we're addressing. I can't address that as any expert in politics or political theory or economic. I only address that as a student of the Bible. That's the only area where I feel like I have any sort of beginning to have any sort of competent grasp. So as you will see from the paper, that will be the focus of my attention. I'm not going to cover all 25 pages. I just leave that for whatever it's worth for you to look at on your own. So I'm just going to select some parts of the paper and read those, and hopefully that'll give us something to talk about. Okay, I am going to start at the top, though, at the introduction. All right, page 1. At the end of this present age, God will bring this crazy narrative in which we are all embroiled to a glorious culmination. At its culmination, we will not exist together in a democratic society. We will exist in the kingdom of God. We will exist in free, uncoerced submission to the monarchical rule of God. We will be ruled over by God himself in the form of his Son, Jesus, our everlasting King. Arguably, then, democracy per se is not the ultimate and ideal form of human government. It is the kingly rule of Jesus that is the ideal form of government. But this ideal will be realized at the culmination of human history. It is not and never will be realized during the span of this present age. The question of concern to us, therefore, is this: how should we be governed, or how should we govern ourselves in the meantime? We are not a people that will freely submit to the rule of Jesus. Far from it. So currently, the ideal is well beyond our reach. What form of human government, then, is most to be desired given the current fact of human rebellion against God? It is my conviction that the Christian believer ought to bring all of his thought and all of his life into conformity with what the Bible teaches. Politics and political thinking is no exception. All too often, Christians' political beliefs are based on the naive, foolish, and self-destructive assumptions of rebels against God, not on the biblical worldview. All too often, Christians' political beliefs are adopted on the basis of fashion, not on the basis of truth and wisdom. I am not, never have been, a political philosopher. There could very well be huge gaps and glaring omissions in my political analysis. But I am a student of the Bible, and I believe that I have acquired a reasonably competent grasp of the biblical worldview. It is on the basis of my knowledge of the Bible, not my knowledge of political theory, that I offer my remarks in this paper. In this brief paper, I want to lay out 14 elements of the biblical worldview that I believe must be taken into account if the Christian believer is to construct a political theory and engage in politics in a manner consistent with the biblical worldview. And there's nothing magical about these 14. These are the 14 that come to mind because I have in mind dialogue with various positions out there. If someone else were to come along presenting a whole new political theory, then there may be something else in the Bible that would be relevant to that. So this is not an exhaustive or definitive list. It's just, this is where I'm at in my world right now. These are the 14 that I think I need to keep in mind. I will state each biblical truth and follow it with a few brief remarks about its relevance to political theory or our current social political situation. I will conclude with some brief comments about American constitutionalism in the light of these truths. It is my contention that all of the following biblical truths are compatible with the foundational political principles upon which America is founded. It is my further contention that all of the other major political viewpoints, statism, socialism, Marxism, communism, communitarianism, or any anti-capitalist perspective, is significantly and fundamentally at odds with one or more of the 14 truths discussed in this paper. The first one I'll just read, and I won't elaborate on it here. Truth one, the ultimate and ideal form of human government involves the free and coerced submission of each individual human being to the monarchical rule of Jesus, the divine Son of God. That's probably not very controversial here, so I'll just leave that uncommented on. Truth number two, likewise, same thing. The state is not God, and it cannot serve effectively as a God. That's huge and very, very important idea, but I don't think it's controversial enough for me to bring into our discussion today. But let's take more time on truth number three. Unequal conditions among human beings are not evil in and of themselves. God's providential care for every one of his creatures is good and sufficient. Beyond doubt, Jesus recommends that we place confidence in the providential care of God. He believes that God is good and caring when it comes to sustaining us as creatures. Jesus says, "For this reason I say to you, do not be worried about your life as to what you will eat or what you will drink, nor for your body as to what you will put on. Is not life more than food, and the body more than clothing? Look at the birds of the air, that they do not sow, nor reap, nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not worth much more than they? And who of you, by being worried, can add a single hour to his life? And why are you worried about clothing? Observe how the lilies of the field grow. They do not toil, nor do they spin. Yet I say to you that not even Solomon in all his glory clothed himself like one of these. But if God so clothes the grass of the field, which is alive today and tomorrow is thrown into the furnace, will he not much more clothe you, you of little faith? Do not worry then, saying, 'What will we eat, or what will we drink, or what will we wear for clothing?' For the Gentiles eagerly seek all these, for your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. But seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be added to you. So do not worry about tomorrow, for tomorrow will care for itself. Each day has enough trouble of its own." The reason we become so horrified when God's providential care does not sustain one of his creatures is because it is the exception, not the rule. As a rule, God is committed to sustaining the life and existence of each and every one of his creatures. But one thing becomes abundantly clear when we absorb the full contours of the biblical message. God is telling vastly different stories in and through the lives of each and every distinct individual creature. It is not God's intention to make all things the same for everybody. He has no intention to bring about absolute equality among human beings. Our fellow human being and brother Jesus is the firstborn of all creation. He will bear that title for all eternity. I'm not the firstborn of all creation. I never will be. Jesus and I are not equals in this sense, and we never shall be. For as long as this earth exists under the sun, the Jews are the special chosen people of God. No Gentile people group can ever legitimately make that claim. All people groups are not equal in this sense. Jesus chose a select group of people to be his apostles. You and I are not, and never will be, apostles. All individuals are not equal in this sense. Clearly, equality of status is not and never has been a priority in God's purposes. Likewise, equality of condition is not a priority with the Creator. Some live lives of toil and poverty. Others live lives of leisure and luxury. Some live lives in insecurity and fear. Others live lives in relative security and peace. Some live long, some die young. Some acquire wealth, fame, power, influence, and success. Others live in obscurity, powerless and unsuccessful individuals. It is the transcendent author of all reality that doles out the scripts of each person's life. The empirical fact is clear. The divine author is not committed to giving every individual the same kind of existence. This fact is quite evident in Jesus' response to the rebuke of one of his disciples when he allowed a grateful woman to anoint him with expensive perfume. seeming to waste a valuable asset that could have been used to alleviate the needs of the poor. Jesus responded, "For you always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me." What is most relevant to our questions here is Jesus' tacit assumption that God, in his sovereign providential care of mankind, will not eliminate human poverty. Here we have the Son of God himself, the one sent from heaven to serve as the very light of the world, expressing his authoritative assessment that you will always have the poor with you. It is not God's intention, it is not a divine priority to eliminate the reality of poverty from among men. Given this fact, we have a choice. On the one hand, we can decide that we are morally superior to the Creator, we can censure him for the evil inequalities in the world, and we can seek to supplant him, taking the authority of deity upon ourselves. Since God is not interested in it, we can make the world a better, more just, more righteous, that is, a more equal world. Or, on the other hand, we can decide that because God is a good, just, and compassionate being, the created inequalities in God's world must not and cannot be inherently evil. Accordingly, we would decide that it must not be a moral imperative to seek to create equality in the conditions of human beings, no matter how much our taken-for-granted cultural assumptions say that it is. It is clearly the latter choice that the Bible instructs us to make. It is our whiny human rebelliousness that carps and complains about ours and others' lot in life. A righteous response on the part of us creatures would be to submit to the will of the Creator, for others as surely as for ourselves, and to accept the fact that it is the divine prerogative to script each individual life exactly as he wills it to be. This fact needs to be qualified in two important ways. First, the source of some of the inequality in the world is human evil. It is caused by one evil human being or group of human beings exploiting others to their harm. This is wrong, unjust, and evil. It is not part of the created, divinely accepted inequality in the world. It is an abomination. To oppose and to strive against evil and injustice is wholly appropriate. Indeed, as a disciple of Jesus, it would be part of what I am called to do. Secondly, submission to the will of God is not passivity in the face of one's condition. Passivity is not a righteous and noble response. It is an ignorant and evil response. As human beings, we were created to be problem solvers. It is anti-intelligent to not seek to obtain food when you are hungry or water when you are thirsty. Some adopt an attitude that says, "If I have no water, it is the will of Allah. I will not drink if God does not put the water glass to my mouth." This attitude is diabolically unrighteous. There is no nobility to such so-called submission to the will of God. Submission to the will of God comes at the end of our seeking to change our condition, not at the beginning. When we have tried to improve our lot in every way that we can and God has thwarted all our efforts, then is when submission must begin. Submission is the righteous way to respond when I have failed in my efforts to improve my condition. I can complain and whine, I can curse God and hate him, or I can acknowledge his right and authority to will my uncomfortable state. This truth number three is highly relevant to our political perspective. Most socialist political theories begin from the assumption that the inequality of wealth, privilege, and opportunity in the world is a grave evil. They assume that God is not doing a good job of taking care of mankind, and therefore that mankind needs to take care of himself. Man must eliminate the scourge of inequality, for God is not doing it. Indeed, it is ubiquitous in modern political attitudes that justice and righteousness demand the elimination of all inequality. Since God is not doing it, the state must. This attitude, from a biblical perspective, is ignorant, short-sighted, foolish, evil, and insubordinate. It takes a truly wise human being to avoid envy. Most fail to avoid it, but avoid envy we must. I must not begrudge the rich man his wealth, the famous man his fame, the influential man his influence, the healthy man his health. God has given me a wonderful gift of life and existence. Whatever the nature and character of that life and existence, it is, in the long run, a good and wonderful creation. If I truly understand that, I will accept my life and will not wish that I had the life that someone else has. So much of modern politics is an appeal to envy at work within foolish and ignorant human beings who have never come to accept the authority of God's will over their lives. This should not describe us Christians who take the Bible seriously. we of all people must be immune to any appeals made to our envy. Envy must not exist among us. Perhaps more importantly, neither should we deem it wise, good, or valid to accommodate or pander to the envy of others. We cannot underestimate how powerful a political force is the guilt that those who have various advantages of condition experience in the face of those who are correspondingly disadvantaged. The wealthy man is tempted to experience uncomfortable guilt when confronted by the poverty of the poor man. But such guilt is a false guilt in the light of a biblical worldview. The blessing of Abraham's wealth or King David's wealth and fame is not a source of moral culpability. Both may in fact be culpable before God, but not because the sovereign author of reality has made them wealthy and powerful. It is God's prerogative to make some rich and some poor. Our refusal to accept that God has the right to do this is one of the most important forces of evil in modern politics today. The political solution tacitly acceptable by many is making deprivation universal. The ideal would be to redistribute wealth so that everyone is just a little poor and no one has the advantages of significant wealth. The worst intentioned embrace this ideal out of an infantile impulse. If I can't be wealthy, then I don't want anyone to be wealthy. The best intentional embrace such an ideal out of the perspective that all of us should be content with having less. This is certainly true and most certainly biblical, but it misses the point. Human existence is not static, it is dynamic. Even if you were to reset the human condition, granting to each human being exactly the same economic resources, inequality would emerge again in no time. The ambitious, the lucky, the hardworking, the creative, the frugal, and so forth, they would begin to amass more resources than their neighbors. Should this be prevented? Should we refuse to allow such a condition to reemerge? Or is God sovereignly in control of just such dynamics? Is it incumbent upon his creatures to allow God to dynamically create just those unequal varieties of human existence that he wants to create? Truth number four, every ordinary human being is morally depraved. I don't need to argue that to this crowd, I don't believe, but I do want to apply that to government here, beginning at point two on page eight, the middle of the page. Every form of government, no matter what form it takes, must ultimately fail in the face of human depravity. What is government in this present age but the rule of evil, depraved sinners over other evil, depraved sinners? Governmental decisions are ultimately made by foolish, ignorant, depraved minds, impassioned by evil and rebellious hearts. This is true whether the government is a democracy or a monarchy, whether an anarchy or a dictatorship. No form of human government can ultimately overcome the problem of human evil, for the government itself will always be a participant in the human evil that is the problem. Every political theory that looks to the power and action of the state to solve every social ill, every statist perspective, is ignorant and naive with respect to exactly this point. Statist political philosophy assumes that government, whatever form it takes, will be a benevolent benefactor and will be there to defend its citizens and give them security. It largely ignores the reality that those in power are sinful human beings who are capable of great evil when handed the reins of government. How can I ultimately trust the state to solve social ills created by human evil when the state is itself constituted by individuals who are imbued with human evil? This was the special insight of the founders of the American political experiment. The founding fathers, strongly influenced by the biblical worldview as well as their own personal experience, were very mistrusting of human government. It was axiomatic for them. Any power given to the state was power given into the hands of evil men. The strategy they adopted in structuring the American Constitution was clear. If the power of government can be divided up and distributed over several different evil people with the specific power to block one another's actions, then we can create the possibility, at least, that the interests, values, and concerns of one group of sinful men can keep in check and thwart the power-grabbing lusts of other evil men. Today, we can see clearly how vulnerable the American Constitution was. It was no match for the evil lust of evil men. When the Constitution stands in the way of evil men getting what they want, then they will readily say, "Damn the Constitution." When there is not enough regard for the established structures and principles of the Constitution to abide by them, then the Constitution is powerless in the face of the human evil. Human evil will always find a way in this world. No government, no political structure can stop or eliminate the effects of it. American constitutional government survived as long as it did because of the momentum and excitement of a people committed to a novel and wonderful new idea. The American experiment, I would contend, is one of the most remarkable stories in the history of mankind. It is, or at least it is quickly becoming, a failed experiment. That will come as no surprise to a Christian who believes that man is fundamentally evil. But for as long as it lasted, or lasts, the American Constitution was one of the most ingenious and one of the noblest experiments in human government that the world has ever known. No attempt at human government has been more in touch with reality than it has. In the end, only one political phenomenon in all of history will prove to have been more interesting than the American experiment, the experiment in pure holiness that God will institute among his own chosen people, the Jews. I think I'm going to skip now down to truth number 5 on page 10. Unchecked human evil is destructive to human existence in this present age. Hence, government is good to the extent that it blocks and prevents the full, unhindered expression of human evil. It is not the role of government to promote true godliness, nor is it the role of government to ensure or guarantee well-being. The role of government is no more and no less than to promote order and civility, that is, to keep in check the expression of human evil. And again, I hope that's non-controversial enough that I'm going to leave that and go to truth 6 on page 11. Freedom in the context of social relationships, that is, political freedom, is unquestionably a desirable, indeed a preferable condition to live in. And I cite mostly Philemon there, but I won't elaborate on that right now. However, truth 7 is an important one correlated to that. Freedom in the context of social relationships, that is political freedom, is not so important that one should focus one's life on attaining or preserving it. I think that can equally be established from the Bible. So, and that's very important. Puts it in a larger perspective. I want to spend some time on truth number 8 on page 13. The Bible assumes and promotes an existentialist concept of human freedom and responsibility, namely that each individual has complete freedom to choose how he will define his existence, and that each individual bears personal individual responsibility for his choice in this regard. To offer a thorough proof that this is the perspective of the Bible is beyond the scope of this brief paper, but it is not that difficult to see, I think, that the existentialist view of freedom and responsibility is fundamental to the biblical worldview. Certainly it is clear in the case of the ultimate decision that a human being must make. No one can get saved for me. I must choose salvation myself out of my own individual freedom. Every human individual is completely free to choose life and blessing or to choose death and destruction. No one can choose for him, and no one but the individual himself can assume responsibility for that choice. This much is indisputable. But is the ultimate decision some sort of special case? Why has God made the ultimate decision of salvation an issue of existential commitment, an issue of individual free choice and individual responsibility? Is there something unique about the decision to be saved or not? Or is individual freedom and responsibility the way it is in every aspect of a person's life? I am convinced that individual freedom and responsibility is operative with respect to salvation precisely because it is endemic to every choice that a human being makes. All of my life belongs to me as an individual. Every choice I make amounts to me deciding and defining what will be the nature of my individual existence. You are what you choose is the slogan that is suspended over the whole of each human life. In other words, in the context of a biblical worldview, individual freedom and responsibility is endemic to what it means to be a human being, as God himself intended it. Accordingly, anyone or anything that removes man's freedom to choose his way through life dehumanizes him, turning him into a beast, a slave, or a child. Anyone or anything that removes man's responsibility for his own existence robs him of his created dignity. This has very important political implications. Any political system that presumes to remove from the individual his responsibility to make his own way through life strips him of something that is essential to his humanity. Such a political system would be evil. One cannot conclude otherwise. It is this truth, number 8, that forms the basis for truth number 6 above. Political freedom is a desirable state precisely because anything less than it is an evil. There is much evil in this world that we are forced to endure. Accordingly, we may not be obligated to eradicate the evil of social political bondage. That was truth number 7. but such an evil is nevertheless evil. While it may not be the ultimate cause to which we believers should commit ourselves, nonetheless, to the extent that we have the opportunity to form, shape, and create our own political structures, it is only right and good that we should create political structures that preserve and defend individual freedom. As biblical Christians, we cannot disregard this important truth. Man was created to be free and to take personal responsibility for his own individual existence. Accordingly, our political structures should protect his individual freedom. They should not remove it and place his existence in the hands of others. No biblical Christian can morally defend a political structure that reduces human beings to beasts, to children, or to slaves of another. Returning to a statement of Jesus we quoted earlier, the kings of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who have authority over them are called benefactors. But it is not this way with you. Jesus appears to have a very different vision of what human government would look like if it were not ignorant and evil Gentiles who were in control. Government would not presume to be the benefactor of the governed, and therefore their slave master. It would rather be the servant of the governed. Many would raise the objection that there are many people who seem incapable of caring for themselves. These individuals are desperately in need of a benefactor. Without a benefactor, they will perish. For this reason, the best political structure will function as the requisite benefactor and will protect people from their own foolish choices, as well as from life's exigencies that are beyond their control. Are not Jesus' followers supposed to be charitable, to love their neighbor? Doesn't such love or charity entail becoming my neighbor's benefactor when he is in need of help? And wouldn't the most powerful force for good occur when we empower government with the authority and wherewithal to be that benefactor to my neighbor in need on my behalf? This is probably the most important question with regard to the implications of biblical teaching for political theory. My answer to this question hinges on an important distinction. There is a significant difference between love, charity, and tending to the needs of a person. One tends sheep and cattle. In the tending of them, one ensures that they get what they need. They get proper food, shelter, and attention to their biological needs. But the provider who tends his sheep or cattle, benefactor though he is not displaying love, charity. He's tending his beasts. Similarly, the master who feeds and clothes his slaves is not thereby loving them and evidencing charity toward them. Finally, the parent who provides for his children has not thereby loved them. This distinction needs to be taken into account when we consider the functioning of government to provide for the needs of the governed. Does the governed manifest love in relation to the governed, or does it tend the governed like sheep? Many Christians assume that the responsibility I have to love my neighbor can be readily discharged if I simply give my consent to government to love my neighbor on my behalf. If government will but give a drink of water to the one who is thirsty, feed the one who is hungry, and care for the one who is sick, then I will not need to. Through my authorizing it to act, I have loved my neighbor through the government's aid. But is that true? Has my neighbor been loved by this? Or has he merely been tended like a beast? If he has been loved, then why does the recipient of government welfare so seldom feel respected? This is, of course, not a problem only for government aid. It is a problem for any institutionalized charity work. We have to take seriously the difference between reaching out in charity to truly love someone and merely seeing to it that one's needs are tended to. The latter is almost always selfish. None of us like the psycho-emotional discomfort of knowing that others lack. One way to eliminate the discomfort of knowing that another lack is to see to it that he no longer lacks. But there's a huge qualitative difference between eliminating my neighbor's lack so that I no longer have to feel psycho-emotional discomfort and eliminating his lack as a genuine act of love. The goal of the first begins at and ends at eliminating his lack. The goal of the latter does not end there. Love persists beyond meeting my neighbor's physical or material needs. Love is committed to knowing, respecting, and honoring my neighbor as well. If I love someone, I will do what I can to make him a free and responsible human being who can live independently of help. I will do what I can to teach him and to empower him to be able to live with the dignity for which God created him. Anything short of this is not love. Accordingly, even if my political views are mistaken, I am not mistaken about this. The Christian believer cannot discharge his moral responsibility to love his neighbor by authorizing a government or any other institution to tend to the economic needs of those who lack. Therefore, I am unpersuaded by any and all arguments to the following effect. Because we are called to love our neighbor, we must support any and every effort to empower government to meet human need. That is, we must support every move in the direction of socialism. Even if socialism can ultimately be defended on other grounds, it certainly cannot be defended on the moral grounds that as Christian disciples, we are morally obligated to love our neighbor. The obligation is to love my neighbor, not to tend him like I do my sheep. And true love, I would argue, can never be manifest in institutional care, including and especially in governmental care. Only an individual person can love another person. So no institution can discharge my responsibility to love my neighbor on my behalf. To pretend that it can is ultimately to forsake my obligation to love altogether. More likely than that, our desire to authorize government to meet the needs of others is to selfishly say to the government, there are some needy people out there. Would you please make their neediness go away so I don't have to feel bad about them? Truth number 9, the well-being of one's soul is vastly more important than one's economic well-being. Accordingly, circumstances that encourage growth of the human soul are more important and more valuable than circumstances that encourage economic growth or economic security. Again, I think that's running out of time here. I'm going to skip that one. Number 10, on the bottom of page 18, only voluntary charity is true charity, love. Coerced charity is not really charity, love at all. Indeed, coerced charity is not a moral good. And then 11, the moral goodness of an act cannot be determined solely by the consequences or outcome of the act. An act with a good outcome can nevertheless be a morally evil act, and an act with a bad outcome can nevertheless be a morally good act. Let me read that. Truth number 11 is a foundationally important philosophical point upon which to base an ethical theory. It deserves much more discussion than I can give it here. I can only attempt to illustrate its truth in order to make it plausible. The fact that the items I stole when I burglarized my neighbor's house provided greater benefit to the poor people I gave them to than they were of benefit to my wealthy neighbor does not thereby make my burglary a morally good act. In general, the fact that an act has good consequences does not in and of itself establish it as morally good. By the same token, the fact that an act has negative consequences does not in and of itself establish that act as morally wrong or evil. The fact that two men died and not just one when a man unsuccessfully tried to save another man from drowning does not mean that his attempt was morally wrong. There are striking examples of this truth in biblical history. First, there are striking examples of clearly evil and malicious deeds having very beneficial consequences. Joseph's brother selling Joseph into slavery, having decided against murdering him, was undoubtedly a heinously evil act. But the outcome, the salvation of the people of Israel from annihilation, was a very good outcome. Clearly, though, the beneficial character of its consequences does nothing to render Joseph's brother's deed morally good. There's an even more striking example. Judas' deed of betrayal has arguably contributed to more good coming to more people than any other act in human history. Clearly, though, the beneficial character of its consequences, eternal salvation to everyone who believes in the significance of Jesus' death, does nothing to render Judas' deed a morally good act. But it works the other way as well. The fact that an action has negative and harmful consequences does not thereby make the action morally wrong. We could find striking biblical examples of this as well. We are told that many of the people throughout history who have believed, proclaimed, and hoped in the promises of God have, because of their faith, been killed, imprisoned, or otherwise persecuted for their faith. Disregarding the fact that they ultimately receive an eternal reward, their act of faith would still nonetheless be morally right in spite of its temporal consequences. The fact that it resulted in suffering and harm does not alter that fact in the least. I'll skip down. Truth 12, according to the explicit and emphatic teaching of the Bible, for example, as illustrated in the book of Revelation, I think, the true colors of human government in this present age is opposition to God and opposition to the people of God and to the things of God. Accordingly, the ultimate destiny of all human government in this present age is condemnation to destruction. There's no such thing as a righteous human government. Truth 13, the ultimate good is a human individual who, as an individual, is rightly related to God. The ultimate good is not the common good or the good of the community. Well, yeah, let me read a little bit of this. The common good is a not very well-defined abstraction. It has, over history, led to great evils. One of the Marxist dictators said, to make an omelet, you have to break a few eggs. This represents the basic logic that necessarily follows from any commitment to the common good. Because if it is the common good, the good of the community that one is interested in, it is of little consequence what particular individuals might have to suffer and be harmed in the process of advancing the common good. There is absolutely nothing in the teaching of the Bible that would support any appeal to the common good or the community. All such rhetoric is utterly alien to the biblical worldview. From beginning to end, the Bible appeals to individuals as individuals with regard to their own particular individual well-being. It is this feature of Jesus' teaching, for example, that so offended Bertrand Russell. Russell was convinced that Jesus was a horrible ethical teacher. He taught what Russell called an entirely prudential ethic that was completely devoid of altruism. What Russell rightly was sensing is that the center of Jesus' concern was the well-being of each and every individual. Jesus appealed to each and every human individual as an individual to be wise and prudent enough to choose to love God and the things of God rather than the things of this passing age. Jesus was the prime example of someone giving up his life and existence in this present age for the sake of others, and the Bible exhorts us to follow Jesus' example. We are indeed to be altruistic in that sense, but there is never any suggestion that we should give up and sacrifice our eternal well-being for the sake of others. Jesus didn't. Rather, it was for the joy set before him that Jesus endured the cross, despising the shame. Indeed, from a biblical perspective, it wouldn't even be possible to sacrifice my eternal well-being to another's benefit. At most, one could only wish that it were possible, as in Romans 9:3. Furthermore, there is never any suggestion that we should achieve disinterest with respect to our eternal well-being and should never be motivated in any way by desire for an ultimate reward. It is expected at every turn that we will have regard for our eternal well-being, that an ultimate reward is what we seek. I'm going to skip down to truth 14. True community results from individual commitments to God, not from individual commitments to community. The Bible does speak of community, especially when it speaks of unity, being of one mind, and of having fellowship. Indeed, it expects faith to result in community. The nature and character of the community that disciples of Jesus will create amongst themselves is expected to be a significant mark of the authenticity of their discipleship. But it is important to note what it is that Jesus and his disciples expect will be the basis for that community. Christian disciples do not form community because they intentionally set out to form community. Rather, they form a community naturally and spontaneously if and when they each determine to embrace the same hope and serve the same Lord. Romans 15 is quite explicit in this regard. Paul begins by asserting that the point of the Scriptures is to persuade us to embrace the hope that God has granted us. He follows by recording the content of his prayer for them, that they all, both Jew and Gentile, might be granted to be of the same mind with one another according to Christ Jesus. Paul's point, it would seem, is that Paul wants both Jew and Gentile to be of the same mind in the sense that they embrace the same hope that has been proclaimed to them. As a result, he desires that they might, with one voice, glorify God. Again, his desire is that they might glorify God due to the hope that they have all been granted by God. Then precisely because they do share a common hope, he proceeds to exhort them to accept one another. The import of what Paul is saying is this: the basis for unity between the Jewish believer and the Gentile believer, and indeed for every believer with every other believer, is the fact that each individual believer has personally confronted and embraced the promise from God that gives him hope. Accordingly, each believer shares exactly the same hope from God. One could describe the same thing differently. Every follower of Jesus has resolved to know, love, and serve his Master. Accordingly, he is of exactly the same mindset as every other follower of Jesus. But what brings him into unity with other believers is not his decision to be in unity with other believers. It is his decision to be committed to the one and only Lord of the universe. Believers are united with one another because they have one and the same Lord, not because they have set out to be one with one another. From a biblical perspective, the basis of unity is far more important than the fact of unity. One could become united on the basis of something that is not worth committing to, even on the basis of something false or evil. But Christian believers are committed to truth, the truth about God and the truth about his son Jesus. Since God is the one and only God, and since Jesus is the one and only Son, a commitment to them causes every believer to be united in the same truth and to be of one mind. What then is the social effect of sharing a common hope and faith? When two people are each in right relationship to God, they will necessarily experience a bond between one another. They will understand one another. They will have simpatico with one another. They will respect one another's values. They will share in common the most important thing in each other's life. It is just such solidarity that forms the bond of love that unites them into a single community. I think I better, for the sake of time, let me jump down to just my concluding remark. I'll end with that. All of the 14 truths listed above are truths that I believe are taught in and promoted by the Bible. None of the major political theories is compatible with all 14 of these truths. None, that is, with the possible exception of something roughly like American constitutionalism. It is quite astonishing how remarkably compatible the founding principles of the United States of America are with the basic worldview of the Bible. Particularly noteworthy is the degree to which the worldview of the founders seems to incorporate a biblical worldview and the degree to which the structures defined by the United States Constitution seem to be informed by the biblical worldview of human sin and evil. It seems to me that no other major political theory accommodates the reality of human sin so realistically as does the United States Constitution. I will not attempt to demonstrate that here. I leave it to the reader to ponder. When I contemplate the nearly miraculous consensus that was reached at the Constitutional Convention, allowing the United States Constitution to become a living reality, it is not chauvinism, I think, but sober reflection that leads me to conclude that America was purposed by God to be a unique experiment in human history. The government established by the American Constitution, with all of its flaws, was perhaps as good a form of government as could possibly be formed to structure a society where sinners could live together in safety and order with a semblance of justice. But as I think we can clearly see today, the American experiment is doomed to fail. Indeed, perhaps it already has failed. If the American Constitution is no match for the nature and extent of human evil, if the Constitution of the United States cannot survive the deceitfulness of sin in the human heart, then no political system can. Yet we can see very clearly today how vulnerable it is to greed, corruption, ignorance, immorality, and perversion. Human evil will and ultimately must win. It is only a matter of time. The only other striking political experiment that God will do in human history, indeed the only one that the Bible explicitly talks about, is the covenant that God made with Israel. That too has already proved no match for human evil. Because the hearts of the ancient Jews were uncircumcised, the old covenant did not produce righteous obedience to Israel's God. But that experiment is not altogether over just yet. God will one day circumcise the hearts of his people. When that day comes, we will see another important phase of that experiment, a government where the inward orientation of the governed is to seek and serve God. That will be a vastly more successful experiment than the American experiment. For while the American experiment was an experiment in how unsanctified sinners might live together well, the New Covenant experiment will be an experiment in how a holy people might live together well. While the American system will prove inferior to the New Covenant, it has shown itself superior to the Old Covenant. The Old Covenant required purity and holiness of unsanctified Jews. The uncircumcised hearts of the governed doomed it to failure. The American experiment did not require purity and holiness of unsanctified Gentiles. It required only a sort of self-restrained civility and decency. In the end, even that much will prove too demanding for unsanctified Gentiles, but it was more successful than the Old Covenant was. When all is said and done, I find the impending death of the American governmental system a truly grievous thing. Short of the rule of God over his own sanctified people, Israel, no more noble and righteous attempt at human government has ever been seen in all of human history. Its disappearance is no slight loss. I believe it is cause for great mourning. I'll turn it over to Tim.
Trying to live by the 14 truths. Jack said in his conclusion, I'm just jumping right into it, that none of the major political theories is compatible with the 14 truths with the possible exception of something like American constitutionalism. Not only do I not disagree with that statement, I think the founders would largely agree with that statement. I think most American historians that don't have an axe to grind would agree with that statement. Jack's 14 truths are largely compatible with the founding principles of the United States. You can hear a lot of Jack's concern is with this kind of like trend towards socialism that seems present in American politics today. He took care to address that, and that's something that obviously the founders are before this kind of advent of socialism. So they're not addressing that so much, but I think largely they'd probably be in agreement with Jack over his assessment of what socialism might do. So the 14 truths are not only compatible with the founding principles of the United States, and this should come as no surprise to us, the people who wrote the Constitution were almost overwhelmingly European Christians, and not merely European Christians, European Protestant Christians. When I did an internship in Washington, D.C. several years ago, I went on a little tour of the Hall of Statues, which is a little antechamber to the Capitol Rotunda. And I remember walking through the Hall of Statues, reading the plaques below all the statues of the founders and the signers of the Constitution and Declaration, and almost to a man, they had a history in the church. They were elders in the church, preachers in the church, pastors in the church, or they came to the United States for the express reason of they wanted religious freedom. So America's founding, as I understand it, and I think it's right to say so, is an overwhelmingly, it's a religious experiment. The founders, the authors of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, were religious and often biological direct descendants of the early English Puritans. These early English Puritans came across to the New World in 1630, and before they boarded the ship that left Southampton, England, their leader, John Cotton, quoted 2 Samuel 7:10, a verse that encapsulates how the Puritans viewed themselves as a new Israel and the new world as a new promised land. 2 Samuel 7:10 says, "Moreover, I will appoint a place for my people Israel and will plant them that they may dwell well in a place of their own." The Puritans viewed their mission chiefly in religious terms, and the United States to some degree inherited that religious sensibility. 200 years after the Puritans sailed, 100 years after the United States was formed into a nation, Alexis de Tocqueville, many of you who have read, came over from France to write about what he saw in the United States. He described America in the middle of the 19th century as a nation with the soul of a church. That's a quote. And another quote, "Christianity in America reigns without obstacle by universal consent. Even though religion in America takes no direct part in the government of society, it must be regarded as the first of the political institutions, for it does not impart a taste for freedom, it facilitates a use for it. Thus, as I see it, the relation between the church and the state during this time functioned in a way that was mutually conducive to both. The state did not mandate belief." Couldn't do that. Founders knew it couldn't do that. Or it ought not do that, I should say. "However, the state did seem to welcome it, provided a place for it. It certainly wasn't averse to Christian belief. And the church, though it was not her primary mission, shaped the hearts of citizens for self-governance, for the sort of freedom that the Constitution provided for." 100 years after de Tocqueville, in the 1950s, though, something seemed to be going wrong. We could debate about when exactly it went wrong, what exactly went wrong, but things seemed to start going wrong. Church attendance in the 1950s was at an all-time high, 60% of adults. In 1952, Eisenhower spoke of our Judeo-Christian concept and the deeply religious faith upon which our sense of government is founded. 2 years later, Congress added "under God" to the Pledge of Allegiance. But those raised in the 1950s, especially those like sincere Christians, sensed that something did not quite seem right. Looking back, many people in this room see an analogy between the Christianity of the 1950s and the Danish church of Soren Kierkegaard's day, a Christian nation in which no individual believes in Christ. I'm exaggerating to make my point, obviously. Kierkegaard tells this story in his book, The Attack on Christendom. "Once there was a barkeep who sold his beer for a dollar less than he paid for it. When asked, 'How do you balance your books?' he replied, 'Don't worry, it's only the big number that counts.' So it was with Christendom in Denmark. No individual honestly believed he was a true Christian, yet somehow when all added together, Denmark was a Christian nation." Kierkegaard, of course, abhorred. This was the height of being lost for him. And I think a lot of people look back at the 50s, not to highlight just that particular decade, but maybe it's emblematic of something that has, like, of the general drift of the United States. We are left with the trappings of the Christian religion, but not like the real heart of it, not the individual that really believed. How long could this situation last? Not very long. So I'm going to read two pages, which are the opening two pages of a book called Resident Aliens. Even that title is going to give you an indication about where I'm going to end up going. The book is written by a guy named Stanley Hauerwas. He is a professor of theological ethics at Duke University, and I'm really compelled by his argument. So a lot of what you're going to hear from me, the rest of the paper, is going to be a lot of Hauerwas's thought. So, opening two pages of Resident Aliens. Christendom ended in Greenville, South Carolina, on a Sunday afternoon in 1963. So says Hauerwas. That evening, says Hauerwas, in defiance of the state-honored blue laws, the Fox Theater opened on Sunday. Seven of us, regular attenders at the Methodist Youth Fellowship, made a pact to enter the front door of the church, be seen, and then quietly slip out the back door to join John Wayne at the Fox. That evening represented a watershed in the history of Christendom, South Carolina style. South Carolina, the last pocket of resistance to secularity in the Western world, served notice that it would no longer be a prop for the church. There would be no more free passes for the church, no more free rides. The Fox Theater went head-to-head with the church over who would provide the worldview for the young, and that night in 1963, Fox Theater won the opening skirmish. Everybody realizes this is somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but he's just trying to put a particular date on it just so to kind of help us establish what's going on. Continuing, our parents never worried about whether we would grow up Christian. The church was the only show in town. On Sundays, the town closed down. One could not buy even a gallon of gas. There was a traffic jam on Sunday mornings at 9:45 when all went to their respective Sunday schools. By overlooking much of what was wrong in the world, it was, after all, a racially segregated world. People saw a world that looked good and right. In taking a child to Sunday school, parents affirmed everything that was good, wholesome, reasonable, and American. Church, home, and state formed a national consortium that worked to instill Christian values. People grew up Christian simply by being lucky enough to be born in places like Greenville, South Carolina, or Pleasant Grove, Texas. But no one much believes this anymore. At least almost no one. Whether we are Pentecostals, Catholics, Lutherans, or United Methodists, we meet very few young parents, college students, or auto workers who believe that one becomes a Christian simply by breathing the air or drinking the water in a generous, hospitable environment of Christendom. Few may still believe that by electing a few Christian senators or enacting a few new laws and tinkering with the federal budget, we can form a Christian culture, but most of us know this view is part of the past. End of quote. So, Christianity, which once shaped public policy, manners, values, habits, nearly every aspect of public and private life, that time has largely ended. Yes, In God We Trust is still stamped on our coins, public school students still say Under God during the pledge, our politicians still take oaths on the Bible, but Christianity is no longer the canopy of meaning under which the nation lives and moves and breathes. We are no longer, so speaking as a Christian, we're no longer at home in which the house our great-grandparents built. Now what? This conference is titled Paychecks, Politics, and Paradigms, and I suspect a lot of you came because you're asking this question. You may not have it in front of your mind. Okay, Christendom is over. Maybe you don't have that. Maybe you're not exactly there. But you do have the sense maybe that things are changed radically, especially in the past 50 years. Some of you came to understand economics better, to discuss the Bible verses bearing on our subject, but a lot of us are trying to figure out, okay, what now? I am going to give you a handful of different choices I think that Christians are sort of leaning to. And I'm going to do those in a very short amount of time because I'm going to devote the majority of my time to two views that I think are the two most viable views. The second to last view that I'm going to lay out is one that I don't actually accept, but I'm going to argue it as best I can. I'm going to argue it with full force because I think it does hold a lot of water. And then the last view that I'm going to present is what my view is. One possible choice in the light of the fact that if you accept my view or accept that like something like Christendom is over, one view is very, very simple. Retreat. Put the walls up and the shutters down. The regime is over. Burn a solitary candle to God until it's snuffed by the barbarian worldview clamoring at our gate. Maintain your personal piety because nothing else matters and nothing else can be done. This is the servant who is given a talent of money by his master. When the master left, his servant buried the talent in the ground and awaited his master's return. But woe to the servant when the master did return. Second possibility. Jack mentioned this the other day, the theonomists. The theonomists' general move is to promote Christianity as law. It shouldn't just inform law. It shouldn't just inform society. No, no. It should be law. Well, okay, with the exception of the stoning rituals. Okay, with the exception of the ceremonial laws. Okay, and no animal sacrifices. Their arguments are so labyrinthine, I don't know if I'm saying that word right, and their numbers are so small that I wouldn't mention them, except a lot of their leading lights are both extremely intelligent and tend to move in homeschooling circles. And I know there are a lot of homeschoolers that have gone to Gutenberg here. I won't mention, for the sake of time and probably also our interest, the libertarian theologians, Christian anarchists, Christian socialists, neo-Christian communists, etc., etc., etc. There's a whole smorgasbord of different views. I'm now going to concentrate on the two that I think are the strongest views. The first one that I'm going to lay out, which I'm ultimately going to disagree with, is the view that we ought to promote civic Christianity. We ought to promote civic Christianity. Let me give it the most robust argument that I can give for it. A Christian looking at what looms over the horizon, this alternate sort of worldview that's coming into focus now, knows that civic Christianity, despite its deep failings, is better than what looms over the horizon, right? The American public square will not remain a vacuum. In the absence of Christianity, some other cultural philosophy will fill the vacuum. Even though we know that civic Christianity is a counterfeit for the real thing, it is still preferable to what looms on the horizon. And what looms on the horizon appears to be a blinkered pseudoscientific paganism that is deliriously intolerant despite all of its self-advertisings for the opposite, and very desperate for power. Thus, civic Christianity, despite its acknowledged shortcomings, is far preferable to the rough-hewn beast that looms on the horizon. It is not just preferable for Christians, but for the larger populace. One of the best defenses that I've heard for this particular aspect of civic Christianity came from a Jewish philosopher in a conversation that he had with Stanley Hauerwas. Again, Stanley Hauerwas is the guy who's kind of like central to what I'm thinking, or he's central in articulating what I'm thinking. Hauerwas recorded his conversation with the philosopher in an essay. They were having a panel discussion, and during the panel discussion, Hauerwas explained why he subscribed neither to religious nor political liberalism. Then the philosopher asked, and I'm going to read about a page and a half of their dialogue. And again, keep in mind what I'm trying to articulate here, that civic Christianity is not just good for Christians. It's good for the broader populace. And this philosopher is going to actually say, it's good for me. I'm not a Christian, but it's good for me. You ought to uphold civic Christianity. That's what he's going to say to Hauerwas. The philosopher then asked, so, Hauerwas, do you support prayer in public schools? Hauerwas, no, I do not, because I do not want the state sponsoring my faith. Philosopher, that's not the real reason. The real reason is you're afraid of being for anything that Jerry Falwell is for. You're really quite a liberal in spite of your doubts about liberalism's philosophical adequacy. Hauerwas, that's not fair. I didn't say I was against school prayer because I think prayer is coercive, though that's an important consideration. No, I'm against prayer in public schools because, insofar as they can pass muster in a religiously pluralistic society, they are so anemic that they cannot help but be giving a distorted view of God. So I am against school prayer, not because it is against the tenets of liberalism, because it's theologically a scandal. Philosopher, that's not good enough. As a Christian, you typically do not give a damn about the Jews. You want to create a civilization and a society and then walk away from it when the going gets a little tough. Of course, the prayers sponsored by public authorities are degraded, but they still remind people that they are creatures. A vague God prayed to vaguely is better than no God at all. Otherwise, we face the possibility of a neo-pagan culture for which liberal procedural rules of fair play will be no match. Hauerwas, I'm surprised to hear you say this. After all, Christians have persecuted and killed Jews with as much enthusiasm as anyone. I would think that you, as a Jew, would feel safer in a secular culture than one that is quasi-Christian. Indeed, has that not been the dominant social strategy of the Jews since the Enlightenment? The way to secure protection from the Christians is to create and support liberal societies where religion is relegated to the private sphere and thus becomes available for public policy directed against the Jews or those of any other religious faith. Philosopher, I do not deny that this is the strategy of many Jews, but I think that this century has shown that to be a decisive failure. pagan societies kill us with an abandon that Christian societies could never muster. Christianity, even in its degraded form, at least has materialistic convictions that can make the persecution and killing of Jews problematic. Paganism has no such convictions. So I will take my chances with the Christians in their societies. After all, we Jews do not ask for much. We just don't want you to kill our children. Living in quasi-Christian societies mean that we have to put up with a lot of inconveniences and prejudice. For example, Christmas is a school holiday. But we Jews have long known how to handle that. We flourish under a little prejudice. What we cannot stand is this false toleration of liberalism. Harawas. So let me see if I understand you rightly. You're suggesting that you want me, as a Christian, to support school prayer, even if such prayers are but forms of degraded Christian religiosity, because at least they continue to underwrite the assumptions we are a religious society. Such an assumption allows an appeal to a higher standard of justice, which makes the survival of the Jewish people more likely. Philosopher. Yeah, that's about right. You Christians have to take responsibility for what you have done. Created a civilization based on the belief in God, and it is your responsibility to continue to support that civilization. Harawas. Now here is where, this is now where Harawas is going to articulate the great merit of his view. But you yourself know, Harawas speaking, but you yourself know that such a social strategy cannot help but lead to the continued degradation of Christianity. The more Christians try to make Christianity sufficient to sustain a society, especially a liberal society, the more we must distort or explain away our fundamental beliefs. Therefore, in the name of sustaining a civilization, Christians increasingly undercut the ability of the church to take a critical stance toward this society. Even when the church acts as a critic in such a context, it cannot be more than a friendly critic, since it has a stake in maintaining the basic structure of society. And therein lies the chief reason why I can't get on with the civic Christian understanding. What our society needs now is not a more vocal civic Christianity. This is to misdiagnose the problem. The problem is not the sickness of the American political system, but the problem is the sickness of the American church. The American church is so emaciated that even if we hoped it could, it can't even cast a shadow called civic Christianity. Why so emaciated is the Christian church? Now, I think Jack and I both know, correct me if I'm wrong, Jack, Jack and I both know where kind of like the center of our debate is. So he highlighted the aspects of like individualism and community. These are important things. This is where the hinge of our debate, I think, is going to lie. So I'm going to also kind of give an explanation as to where I think here. I expect we'll probably talk about it a decent amount during the question and answer, if we have any time. Okay, why so emaciated? I will highlight but one aspect, though I think if we went around the room, we could come up with many, many, many reasons why the American church seems so emaciated. One of them that I'm going to highlight is this habit among Americans toward a hyper-individuality. Now, I'm going to be very careful in explaining this. It's no surprise that people recognize, it's kind of in the modern idiom that Americans are individualistic. De Tocqueville recognizes this in the late 19th century, saying, Americans have this tendency to appeal only to individual efforts of their own understanding. Everyone shuts himself tightly within himself and insists on judging the world from there. There's plenty of good that can come from this tendency toward individuality. We're a nation of innovators, explorers, self-made men and women. But it has placed an unwarranted emphasis on individuality. And again, let me be clear about what I mean by individuality. It is not the sort of individuality that Kierkegaard advocates, the sense that I always am responsible for myself. I am the one who is standing before God. No one else is responsible for me but me. I can't hide behind creeds. I can't hide behind the church. I can't do any of that. It's me, fundamentally. I have to answer for myself before God. It's only I who can resist my stubborn will, my lazy heart, my overbearing pride. When I understood, I'm just talking as Tim now, when I understood Christianity after years of groping in the dark, I realized, I have to embrace this subjectively as a single man, because it is I who stand before God, it is I who must decide. So to remove individuality from Christianity is to lose the whole thing. But here's the big point that I need to emphasize. Individuality is a necessary but not sufficient condition of the Christian life. In other words, the Christian life requires individual commitment, but that is not all that it requires. An acorn is necessary to eventually have an oak tree, but it is insufficient without water, soil, and light. And I think it's a truncated view of the New Testament's message to see Christianity only in individualistic terms. So let me now give a little bit more explanation as to what my view is. Christians today ought to identify chiefly with the church as the servant community of Christ and secondarily with the state. Followers of Christ ought to think and live in keeping with the church before Constantine, primarily in God's polis, in God's world, in God's nation, in God's government. A servant community that lives in the expectation of the full reign of God. Christians, believing in Jesus' life, death, and resurrection, take up Israel's vocation to imitate God and depict God's kingdom to the world. The Apostle Paul preached, "The God who created all things through Jesus Christ, to the intent that now the manifold wisdom of God might be made known by the church to the principalities and powers in heavenly places." We ought to think of ourselves and see ourselves as a servant kingdom. Echoing Jesus' Sermon on the Mount in the Old Testament Proverbs, Paul depicts how the occupants of God's kingdom should relate to each other. "Let nothing be done out of selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind. Let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for his own interests, but for the interests of others." And why should we do this? Because this is the exact pattern set by the Lord himself, who, though being equal with God, willingly humbled himself. Christ Jesus, being in the form of a man, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself into no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant and coming in the likeness of men. He humbled himself to the point of death, even the death on the cross. And how should the followers of God engage with the broader society and state? This is obviously a huge question. I'm just going to kind of like sample a few things. Though we have been promised future blessedness, we are now to humble ourselves as Christ humbled himself. We are, echoing Paul in Romans 13, to bless those who persecute us, not repay evil for evil, or to avenge ourselves, since vengeance is of the Lord, but we are to overcome evil with good. If our enemy is hungry, we are to feed him. Thirsty, we are to give him drink. And although we are subject ultimately to God, we are now to be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. We read this yesterday, Romans 13. I'm going to skip ahead to a story that I think starts to articulate what I'm imagining. The followers of Christ exist in God's polis, a servant community that lives in the expectation of the full reign of God. 3 years ago, a gunman entered a quiet Amish community in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, and though he had no quarrel with the Amish, he lined up six Amish girls aged 6 to 14 and shot them before turning the gun on himself. Authorities found a bag of items that implied that he had planned to sexually abuse the girls before he shot them. He thankfully did not. 5 of the girls he shot died. 4 of the 5 recovered enough to eventually rejoin their school. One of them, Rosanna, is confined to a wheelchair and ultimately unable to talk or feed herself. The TV media descended upon the Amish community and filled the airwaves with their typical technicolor vomit. Better gun laws. Why do so many Americans like this gunman suffer from mental illness? We must improve the healthcare system. One newspaper editorialist even pointed out that too few people were complaining about the gunman's misogyny. He had, after all, thrown the boys out of the classroom and only shot girls, highlighting the specter of misogyny that haunts America. I mentioned that just because miss the forest for the trees. Meanwhile, the Amish people weren't talking gun laws, mental illness, misogyny, or health care. They were trying to prepare their hearts to forgive the gunman. Grandfather of one of the murdered girls was heard warning some young relatives to not hate the killer, saying, "We must not think evil of this man." Another Amish father noted, "This man had a mother and a wife and a soul, and now he stands before a just God." About 30 members of the Amish community attended the gunman's funeral. A year after the shooting, the Amish donated money to the widow of the gunman who'd killed their children. The Amish, who are not known for coveting the spotlight, made one public statement. This is not all of it, but this is a section of it. "Forgiveness is a journey. You need help from your community of faith and from God to make and hold on to a decision not to become a hostage to hostility. It is understood that hostility destroys community." Maybe the Amish world is a little too alien for us, so I'll try to come up with another example that at least sort of typifies what I'm talking about. This story is very close to home. 5 months ago, Imago Dei, a church that I attended when I lived in Portland, joined with several other churches to serve Portland. They did this on one weekend with hundreds of church members descending with their rakes, shovels, paintbrushes, etc., to renovate Portland's public school facades. The school beautification projects saved the district almost $500,000 in landscaping and labor costs, according to Portland Public Schools. And afterwards, the church presented a $100,000 check to city government for homeless and school dropout programs. The check was received by the openly gay mayor of Portland, Sam Adams, who noted that Portland was renowned for its hostility to Christianity, but that should probably end. The efforts of these churches were so welcomed that Portland City Schools hoped that they would do it again next year. So again, to try to put more clarification on what I'm saying, instead of a unity of spheres, individual, political, and spiritual, we ought to, as the early Christians did, see that we live in a two-tiered world. The first tier, our primary allegiance is to God, the way of God, and the people of God. The second tier, being a Christian does in no way sever our ties to our citizenry. We have obligations that extend beyond our Christian community to be good citizens. And, unlike the Apostle Paul, we have the privilege of living in a democracy, a political system which legally encourages us as citizens to participate in our own governance. Despite the fact that we have been given rights as a citizen, the church's primary mode of political action is not to clamor for our rights, but to serve others. Living as a community of servant in no way means that our beliefs won't inform that service. For example, a crisis pregnancy center helps pregnant women, many who are struggling with physical, emotional, and financial problems. These pregnancy centers serve the women by trying to find shelter, medical attention, and financial help, but they also operate by the basic Christian belief that life is from God, and thus they urge the mother to keep her baby, because to end a pregnancy is to end a life. Okay, I'm just going to go to my little closing paragraph, and then Jack and I can talk. We are running late. I am so sorry. We should expect our beliefs, when met with secularizing forces, of course, will be resisted. If our goal is primarily to uphold our country, won't we be more likely to sacrifice our beliefs for the good of the state, or at least to curb our beliefs? Or, if not sacrifice them, allow them to be pre-digested and made more palatable for consumption by the larger public? Howard Wassum, again, I'm going to read a short quote from him. The more Christians try to make Christianity into a philosophy necessary to sustain a society, the more we must distort or explain away our fundamental beliefs. Therefore, in the name of sustaining a civilization, Christians undercut the ability of the church to take a critical stance toward this society. Even when the church acts as a critic in such a context, it cannot be more than a friendly critic, since it has a stake in maintaining the basic structure of society. That's the end. So I think our setup was I leave Jack with a question, and he responds, and then Jack leaves me with a question, and I get to respond.